Kathy Clark Fisher, an editor here at the IEEE Computer Society. Today we're talking with Don Schaefer, Chief Safety and Technology Officer with the Athens Group, an independent software consulting firm that provides risk mitigation and problem remediation services to the offshore oil drilling industry. He's written an article with Penn State University professor Phil LaPlante entitled "The BP Oil Spill: Could Software Be a Culprit?" which will appear in the September-October issue of IT Professional magazine. Don, what is your experience with the software used on offshore oil drilling rigs?
Here at Athens Group, we started working with offshore rigs in 2002. At that point in time, the first, what was known as the fifth generation rigs were coming out. We started out again with some of these very, very complex rigs, and we worked on some of the very first rigs that had full software automation.
Did Athens Group work on Deepwater Horizon?
No, unfortunately we didn't. Transocean is one of our customers, and we've worked on a number of Transocean rigs, and BP is also one of our customers. We've worked on a number of BP rigs, but we never worked on the Deepwater Horizon, unfortunately.
Can you tell us what role software plays in the operation of today's oil rigs?
Absolutely. There's really nothing on those deepwater rigs that isn't controlled or doesn't have software on them. Everything from the vessel management systems that include oil or gas detection, fire detection, smoke detection, through the actual control systems, software is an integral part of all of that, from controlling the drill string to taking data from sensors that are in the downhole themselves. So think of today's advanced passenger aircraft. You couldn't fly a Boeing aircraft or an Airbus without 5 to 10 redundant computer systems. And it's the same way on offshore rigs.
And can you tell us some of the most common oil rig-related software issues?
The majority of non-productive time that occurs on a rig when they're not drilling or there's some issue, about 30% of that is directly related to the drilling control system software. In the case of the Deepwater Horizon, where we were talking about the alarms had been turned off, there's a lot of issues with too many alarms coming in. One of the rigs we worked on, a fairly advanced rig, when we went in and did a mapping of all the alarms, there were over 2,700 individual alarms that could have been enunciated to the driller. That ended up being more than 90 pages. As Phil and I mentioned in the article, the issue becomes one of what the standards say, or you should have no more than one alarm per minute. If you've got a really bad situation, you may have 2 to 5 alarms per minute. What we saw in some of our analysis was you'd have 100+ coming in an hour, and there's no way you could handle 100+. Many times alarms, you'll hear an alarm go off, but it'll be buried 3 to 5 screens down on a driller's console, and they'll never see it. One of the issues with the industry itself, there are multiple systems. There's probably 4 main drilling control systems that would be out there, and they're fairly, you know, automatic. A driller sits in a chair. It's got usually a couple of touch screens available to the driller. There's 2 joysticks on it. There's other controls on the chair itself, and in front of the driller will be anywhere from 2 to 7 different screens, which could be closed circuit TV screens, which would be screens showing how the equipment is operating. It takes drillers months to learn how to use a system, and then many times they'll use a single system for several years. But when they move from one system to the next, it's an entirely different environment. And things like the joystick on one chair, if I push the joystick forward, it means I'm going to put more pressure on my drill string, and I'm going to then add weight on bit and drill faster or deeper. On another chair, if I push forward on the drill on the joystick, it means I'm going to release a piece of equipment from one of the rackers. So there's no standard set of alarms. There's no standard set of commands. One of the issues that we have in the offshore industry is a real lack of standards for alarm systems, for human-machine interfaces. Every time you bought a new car, the steering wheel would be in a different place. So as you move from job to job, from chair to chair and rig to rig, you really have to stop and think about what it is that's different in that rig.
What percentage of oil rigs have these alarm-related problems?
Well, I think all of them do. Probably every rig that's been built since 1998 has the potential for alarm-related issues. One of the electrical technician from Transocean who had testified in the hearings a couple of weeks ago said that it was, from his point of view, it was common practice across the fleet to turn the alarms off.
And why was that?
In many times, and I've been on rigs and been in the driller's cabin where some of the rigs have a large siren, a large alarm horn right at the back end of the driller's cabin. Now, the driller's cabin is anywhere from 8 feet by 12 feet. It could be 12 feet by 20 feet. But if you can imagine having a large horn in your office right behind your your head, which goes off every time Windows sends you a message. So that's what was happening, and you'd have all these alarms going off, and there were two things that most drillers would do. One was they'd either hold down this large red mushroom button, which did a clear all alarms, irrespective of what the alarm said, so that it turned everything off, or they'd get one of the electrical technicians to come in and clip the wires on the horn.
What are the root causes of alarm problems on rigs like the Deepwater Horizon?
Wow, when you look at it, you got to go back and look at the overall software development process. The software development process, we'd written some articles several years ago. One of them was called "Would You Like Software with That?" Because one of the issues was that software was almost an afterthought, that it was not specifically spec'd, that I had software that would run very well, an individual piece of equipment. Equipment vendors aren't out there building things that don't work. The issue becomes one of how do we integrate everything together? So as you walk backwards through the life cycle, you have to say, well, where do the alarms get specified? And as a drilling contractor or an operator being somebody like a BP or a Exxon or Marathon, in their contracts, they don't have specific language that talks about the software. They may have an inch thick document that says, how do I paint the drill ship or how do I paint the semi-sub, but they have zero information in there on the software itself. So it really goes back to, the buyer having to specify the software in the contract. And we're working now with a number of the major oil companies, helping them to put that software language into their contract specifications. And then if you think about it, if I don't have any requirements, well, then I don't have anything to really test against. And if I don't have anything to test against, well, I accept it when I go to the factory and I see that, oh, yeah, it moved the pipe around fine, so it must work. And the only time all this equipment comes together is when I finally put it all on the drill floor. They buy the best equipment. They know that all the equipment works, but they never integrate it together. In the article that Phil and I wrote, there's a diagram in there that shows the interfaces amongst all this equipment, and that white space never gets addressed until they install it all.
You mentioned they put it all on the ship, and then sometimes they don't even test the software when it's loaded onto the ship.
Right. Yeah. When the ship gets built in the shipyard, there have been times where you leave the shipyard, and we build a number of cost avoidance models for some of our clients, because what are you saving when you look at getting the software spec'd earlier or mitigate these risks? In a shipyard, if you miss a day in a shipyard, they're going to charge you $200,000 per day for every day past your contract time that the ship's in the yard. We're building so many of these, and there's so much shipping being built that there's no slots available to build a new rig until sometime around 2012. There's a lot of pressure to get them out, and they get them out, and they usually keep an A list and a B list. And for a shipyard, an A list is, well, I've got to make sure I check all the welds, I've got to make sure the paint's right. I've got to make sure I've done all the stress tests on all my decks. I've got to make sure the propulsion system works fine. The B list is, oh yeah, you got to make sure that the driller's chair interfaces correctly with the pipe handler. And if it's not on the A list, it doesn't have to get done in the yard. And it ends up, you may be doing it. Most of these are built in South Korea. We've got an office in South Korea at the Samsung Heavy Industries yard. And when it leaves South Korea, as a drill ship, it may then go to the North Sea, it may go to the Gulf of Mexico, it may go to Brazil or Africa. So it's got a 3-month, anywhere from a 2 to 3 month really shakeout cruise where they check everything out. We've been on those cruises where equipment vendors have had programmers the whole time writing the code. Imagine this, Kathy, when you leave today and you've got to go back from, leave Los Alamitos and you've got to go back to the Washington DC office. Mm-hmm. And you go to LAX and you get on that new airplane. And this is the first one that they've ever built. And as you're walking on to go sit down in your first class seat that IEEE will pay for, you realize that this guy comes on who's got kind of green spiked hair and is carrying a laptop. And he goes into the cockpit. And you take off. And you're somewhere over Nevada, maybe Colorado. When the guy comes out, you say, hey, that's interesting. Are you a pilot? What are you doing in there? And he says, oh, no, I'm the systems programmer, and I'm writing the landing code. We haven't written that yet.
Wow. Now, just to go back a little bit to the alarms, what could be done to reduce the amount of alarms? Why are there so many alarms going off? What kinds of things are tripping these alarms?
When you look at the alarms could be everything from, I've got a serious gas bubble at the bottom of the well that's going to push up and cause a kick. Two, I may be using a Windows system that for one of my servers, and the driller gets a message that says it's time to defragment your disks.
That causes an alarm?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, that could cause an alarm on some of these systems. So you start looking at it and say, wait a minute, out of these 2,700 alarms, what are the most important? So you want to go through and do some prioritization of the alarms. The key, what we found when we go in and work on helping with the alarm management is we go back to basically getting a list of all the alarms and then working backwards to ensure that the alarm has the right enunciation point. Many times an alarm shouldn't be enunciated at the driller's cabin. Maybe the alarm should be enunciated at an electrical technician's station. Maybe it should be at someone else's station. And you want to make sure they're going to the right places. You also want to make sure that they're calibrated correctly. Sometimes you'll find an alarm that the sensors have been misset or miscalibrated, and I alarm when the sensors are reading too low. So I get these erroneous alarms that don't mean anything. Other times, they may be set and they don't alarm soon enough, and a piece of equipment overheats and burns out. We've had one situation where one of the pieces of equipment, they swapped it out, a new piece of equipment, it had new PLCs, and the PLCs are programmable logic computers. And so these are small industrial computers that basically do the control of the operations. And when they swapped it out, the PLCs had different code in them. And some of the alarms were the same, but some of the alarms were different. And one of the alarms that was different was the overheat alarm. And this piece of equipment, it overheated once and shut down. They went in and had to replace a motor and the sensors, several thousands of dollars and downtime. And oh, by the way, on these rigs, the cost per day on a rig can easily be $1 million a day. So when you have to take a rig down, you're losing $1 million a day. It's your cost. It's going to cost you that no matter what, let alone, you know, opportunity cost of not getting oil or gas out. So they had to swap it out. They swapped it out with a new motor. They figured the sensors were wrong. It's obviously a hardware problem because these guys are very hardware-centric. Started it up again, and a week later, they caused a fire. It not only overheated, but it caused a fire in one of the compartments. And what they found out was after, and we went out and actually looked at it for them, that what happened was when they put the new software in, they didn't enunciate the alarm at the same place, and literally the alarm was never connected. And so there's the issues are, you know, how do you fix alarm management? Well, first you've got to go out and really understand what alarms are necessary, prioritize them, make sure they're correct and in the correct place. And then also you've got to put in, you know, as a software engineer, you've got to do software configuration management because software changes on these rigs. I may change out software. I may have a software change on a piece of equipment once a month or once a quarter. Well, anytime I change out the software, I have a chance of screwing up a set of alarms. Once you get it down to the, you know, the highest priority alarms, it's then a matter of really training all of the operators. And we do a really good training in the industry. The drillers get good training. All of the vendors have training centers and simulation centers where they can do the training. It's just that every rig is really different. And even when we're working with one of our customers where we're working on a fleet of four, and the first of the four drill ships is coming out in a couple of months. So we've got 12 people working on those four rigs over probably about 3 years. What happened, and I put this together because the first thing that drilling contractors say when they build a fleet is, oh, it's a cookie cutter. Everyone's the same. If you get one right, everyone will be fine. And I just put together a little timeline for them, and all of them have the same PLCs on, these programmable logic computers. They're all made by Siemens. They're Cymatic 7s. And I said, yeah, they're all the same. And I said, okay, let me show you what you've got on the very first rig. The very first rig that's coming out will have this model on it, but this model is going to be obsoleted by Siemens about the time you go into acceptance testing. The second rig will have a different set of computers on it at the control level, the most basic computers. And by the time the fourth one comes out, it will yet have a third type of PLCs on it. So every one of those operating systems is slightly different. Every one of the programs inside will be slightly different. And so you can't say it's a cookie cutter because really every rig is different. One of the worst things that happens is an electrical technician will get a piece of software that works just fine on one rig and is very comfortable with it, and the software's in most of these cases, when you look at the programmable logic computers, it's not just the code itself, but there's also configuration tables. A lot of this equipment you have to configure when you put it in place, and the values in the configuration tables are really slightly different for every piece of equipment. And we've seen electechs that have moved from one rig to another and said, oh, I've got the same software problem. Let me install my software that I know that works. And all of a sudden, it works a little bit, but then they start dropping pipe. Other things happen because the configuration was different, and they didn't reconfigure everything. But to reconfigure something like a pipe racker, which is a fairly large piece of equipment that holds tons of pipe, can take anywhere from a couple of days to a week. And wow. Nobody wants to do that. So right. They just reloaded the software, and all of a sudden, pipes started falling on the drill floor.
This is all amazing to me. So I wanted to ask you, through this whole interview, you've been saying it's pretty clear there's no oversight. There seems to be no regulation about the software. There seems to be no standard. So with the interviews that you're doing, what are you hoping to, what is your goal with the article and with these interviews? Are you pushing for more standards in the industry?
Well, Kathy, I'd love to be able to do the standards. We've talked to the American Petroleum Institute. We work with the International Association of Drilling Contractors. They're aware of the problem, but the issue is one for them is the standards. They don't have a real good grasp on how to put the standards together for software. We're trying to help in those areas. What we use, and we've developed our own set of proven practices, and the most valuable set of standards that we use are the IEEE standards. The software engineering body of knowledge, we put that in place. We try and promote that throughout all of our clients. So we go back to the basic references. 12207 talk about the processes of software engineering, the software engineering body of knowledge. It's amazing that when you think of all the work we've done, and a lot of us that have worked on SWEBOC or worked on the different standards, that it's very well known in the EE arena, but when you get to offshore oil and gas, the majority of the people there are, if they're engineers or mechanical engineers or civil engineers, and many times they still frighteningly refer to computers and anything that has to do with computers as the magic boxes. So it's a different world. It's amazing sometimes.
It sounds like the Athens Group is using SWEBOC. How about other firms like yours?
There are some small companies that do some of the similar things that we do, but there's not a whole lot of software companies that do this type of thing. And I think the reason why is that when we go out on rigs, we've got about 50 people in the company now. And one of the hiring criteria is you have to be a good swimmer, and you have to not get motion sickness, and you have to be able to go through the survival training where you get dumped upside down in a helicopter and have to swim out. And you have to go through firefighting training, because when you're on a rig, as with the Deepwater Horizon, that fires happen, things happen. There's no fire department there. You're your first responder. So when we go offshore on rigs and they check our certifications, we not only have to have all the safety certifications, but we also have to say, you know, we've been through the training. We know how to put on the hazardous environment suits. We know how to get on the rebreathers in case you make a mistake and drill into hydrosulfuric acid. You have to have this this mindset that, you have to be an adrenaline junkie to want to do it. There's just not a lot of software engineers who want to go out on a rig where you might get blown up.
Right. Yes, that is a bad side effect of the job. Now, why does the industry lack standards for interface and testing?
If you go back to in our industry, in electronics, we focus pretty heavily on, you know, what's the pinout, what's the bus structure, what's the hardware look like, how do I build the cables, up through the 1970s. Now, we didn't coin the term software engineering until 1968. When we decided that we needed standards in semiconductors, that was in the late 70s, and it took 20 years to get a good set of semiconductor standards, so that now if I really do have plug and play. And we just haven't started it yet in this industry. I'd love for us to be able to get some standards started through people like the American Petroleum Institute, some of the other classing organizations. That's really where it's going to have to get adopted. I mean, we use ISO, we use IEEE, we use IEC, we use those, but they're not adopted across the board. And many times it's not because people don't want to, they just don't know that these exist. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do is promote the awareness that these exist, that it's proven practices, that it's not a bloody magic box.
Right. Now, speaking of boxes, you mentioned in the article in IT Professional that there are no black box type of devices to record data about what happened or what went wrong. Can you speak a little more about that?
Sure. There are some of the vendors under their driller chairs have, they refer to it as a flight recorder. They've got some of those things. Because there are so many different vendors, and if you go back and look at what on the Deepwater Horizon, Schlumberger was out there, Halliburton was out there, MI SWACO was out there, and then BP was there, Transocean. The rig had probably at least three major equipment vendors' equipment on it. So in order to be able to collect the information in a consistent fashion, you'd have to have a set of standards that say, this is what a record looks like, this is what a record that goes across my network looks like, these are all the different possibilities that could happen and the types of records I'd have and the data that's on there. And the standard we've got is in fact, on many of these rigs, I've got anywhere from three to five different networks. I've got standard Ethernet. I've got fiber. I've got twisted pair. I've got Profibus. I've got VesaBus. I've got different types of industrial Ethernet. So having a flight recorder per se, you just can't build one right now because you have to, again, tailor it for each rig. I just got some data the other day that showed what the drilling regime looked like an hour before, and you see the beginnings of the pressure building up. There's data there, and it's not the Halliburtons of the world and the BPs and Transocean aren't covering up data. We just don't have the ability to get it out quickly enough or to find it. It becomes a real problem in trying to go back and say, what was the real root cause? Was the root cause the cementing? Was the root cause the fact drilled the well incorrectly? Was it the blowout protector? In some of these cases, we can pull some of those pieces of equipment back and do some forensics on it, but we just may never know because the data may just never have been kept.
And working in the industry, is the Athens Group or others trying to take steps now to propose best practices or other things that could keep humans and the environment safe?
Yes, there. In fact, we had a conference in Houston 2 weeks ago. The Department of Energy is pulling together a number of organizations. In fact, we're writing a white paper right now on the what some of the preventative measures can be, what some of the new cleanup measures can be, and what some of the environmental protection measures can be. And that's going to be put out probably in the 1st of September, and the Department of Energy will be putting that out. But there was representatives from Transocean, BP, we're represented on the team. There were about 100 of us that came together and spent a day trying to decide what were some of the things we could do and implement fairly quickly. So we're talking about standards. We're talking about new procedures. And we knew, you know, there's always this possibility that something like this could happen. But again, this was a horrible, horrible disaster. The loss of life, the environmental damage, everything that went on was just horrible. And I think that when you look at the responses, you know, we'd never had anything like that happen before. This was new, and it's a game changer. You know, we're going to have to do better, and we're going to have to find better ways to mitigate this ever happening again.
And what do you think we should do?
Well, I think a number of things we should do is, you know, you go going back to the, you know, the basics of getting standards in place, getting the alarm management in place, and then some of the other things we should be doing are automatically drilling things like relief wells. That should be part of what we do. We do that in the North Sea. Going to drive the cost up, but you know, after $32 billion, $100 million doesn't look like much. I think that we have to be careful not to overreact and say we're going to shut down all the drilling, because you know, if we shut down the Gulf of Mexico, that's interesting, and we'd have clean beaches after a while and we'd never have to worry about this again, but we would probably have to make sure that we supported Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and everybody else for a long time, because you know, we've got to take steps to get off of oil. And until we do that, all that means is if we cut down drilling in the Gulf of Mexico or producing in the Gulf of Mexico, we're going to be buying it from somebody else.
Now, we said a lot in this interview about what's wrong. Can you tell us what the oil industry is doing right?
It may seem probably not a good statement now, but safety is one of the things that we really do address well. You know, this was a horrible disaster, but we don't have anything like this happening every day. We don't have these types of either environmental incidents or really safety incidents every day. The other thing we're doing is we're really pushing the envelope in many ways. There's some enormous advances we're making in developing control software. Now, we're not doing it the best, but we couldn't be drilling at those depths. And if you think about the intervention well that they drilled, you have to think of, I'm going to be, again, in over a mile of water. And once I hit the bottom, I'm going to drill two wells that are going to go off 5 to 10,000 more feet. And I'm going to hit a spot that's 8 inches in diameter. Sitting on my driller's chair, a mile above, the surface. We do that because we've made some incredible advances in how to do control software. So although we have an enormous way to go, we can make some really better advances. We've done some very interesting things.
Now, I wanted to ask you, do you have any parting thoughts, either about what we've discussed today or in general looking forward, any kind of standards or industry regulations, anything you'd like to tell us?
Yeah, I think just I'd like to, anybody who listens to this, anybody from IEEE that can go out and help us beat the drum here at Athens Group to get some better standards and to really understand the place of software, and that we can build software, it can be deterministic, and we don't have to view things as magic boxes.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Don, for your time. Again, we've been talking about Don Schaefer and Phil LaPlante's article in the current issue of IT Professional Magazine. Thanks, Don.
Thank you so much, Kathy. Have a great day.